Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll hear about changes that Wright State University made to their engineering and computer science curriculum that's increasing retention and graduation rates for students. Springfield has erected a statue to honor boxing legend Davey Moore, 50 years after his death from blows he received in the boxing ring. WISO's Wayne Baker has that story, and later in the program, Bill Felker will tell us what changes are taking place in the natural world around us. Up first, in the wake of the naval base shootings in Washington, D.C. last week, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base officials offered a review of help agencies they have available for personnel on the base. At a press conference last week, Colonel Cassie Barlow, commander of the 88th Air Base Wing at Wright-Patt, ran through a list of services available, including sexual assault and victim advocate programs, mental health and faith services, health and wellness, substance abuse and education programs for military and civilian personnel. Barlow says in order to prevent tragedies like the one in D.C., all personnel should consider themselves team members. She calls them wingmen.
We train everyone to recognize in their wingmen stress. And, you know, a little bit of stress is okay, extreme stress and problems with resilience, so that they can then help each other. And if they need to get to one of the helping agencies that I just mentioned, they can then take them and they can help them with that.
Barlow added that there is a dividing line between personnel dealing with mental health issues and gaining security clearance in the Air Force.
I believe the Department of Defense and the United States Air Force has very robust screening programs through our security classifications. In order to get a security classification, you have to go through a very, very robust screening program. So that's where it all starts.
Major Angelica Escalona is the Director of Psychological Health at Wright-Patt. She says no base personnel or their family members have expressed direct concern over the incident like the one in D.C., but the base is taking it seriously.
It's a very big deal. We try to really encourage people to seek mental health services, and we really try to destigmatize mental health problems by just trying to be inviting and allowing people to know that they can come seek help.
The number of homes sold in Ohio in August hit a new high, and home sales are maintaining a steady upward trend in the Dayton area as well. From July to August in the Dayton market, there was virtually no change in the number of properties sold, but compared to the same time last year, sales volumes were up by 19%.
So this is a steady increase. It is not something that just goes up, you know, periodically and then goes down.
Nancy Farkas is the president with the Dayton Board of Realtors. She says the housing market here, which includes Dayton and surrounding suburbs, has been up for 25 of the past 27 months.
So I feel very positive about where we are. I don't have any worry, and I think everybody, not only the realtors and the realtor community, but the buyers and the sellers, everybody's feeling very positive about what's happening.
But Dayton still faces housing issues. 6,500 vacant and blighted structures in the city need to come down. For thousands of properties around the city that are designated as blighted properties, demolition is the only answer. The City of Dayton Division of Housing Inspection is responsible for tearing down those structures. Supervisor Kevin Powell says the division focuses on the worst houses, and that number has grown dramatically in the last decade.
In 2002, 2003, 2004, the city was averaging about 50 demolitions. Now we're trying to go over 500 demolitions. So nearly a tenfold increase in the amount of demolitions that we're attempting to get accomplished.
Powell says home values will increase as these houses are torn down, but funding sources for programs like neighborhood stabilization and Moving Ohio Forward are drying up. Those grants have poured millions of dollars into cities like Dayton.
We hope that there's more funding coming from the neighborhood stabilization, because this is a huge problem for all the cities across the Midwest, and it's a huge problem for the city of Dayton.
Powell says the city is looking for other potential funding sources, but he says the problem is a long-term one. He thinks it could take at least 10 years to demolish nuisance properties in the city. Meanwhile, vacant properties are also keeping city workers busy. WISO's Lewis Wallace reports demolition or not, abandoned lots are extra work.
Even after demolition, empty lots can become dumping grounds for tires and other trash, and the city has to clean that up.
If it's abandoned or vacant, yes, then unfortunately we're we're stuck with it.
That's Fred Stovall with the City of Dayton Public Works Department. He says the city tries to mow those 6,000-plus lawns three times a year.
The reason we're cleaning and mowing them is because we're trying to maintain quality of life in these neighborhoods and not just let them, you know, be totally abandoned, overgrown, dumped on, draw rodents, and all those kind of good things.
The only way out of the responsibility is if people start buying up those properties. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
Legislators have been hashing out the future of food stamps in Washington this week, but here in Ohio, changes to food assistance, also called SNAP, are coming down the pike regardless. Work requirements will go into effect October 1st for 134,000 Ohioans who depend on food stamps. Reporter Lewis Wallace was also Emily McCord's guest on Politics Ohio this week to fill us in on the details about what's taking place.
People receiving food assistance across the state are seeing big changes to their benefits. And it's really a mix of political decisions happening here in Ohio and in the federal government. I'm joined today by WYSO's economics reporter, Lewis Wallace, who's been following this story. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Emily.
First, what does it mean for Ohioans that these work requirements are going to go into place October 1st?
So what's going on there is that Ohio has had a waiver in effect since 2009 that basically allows people who normally have to meet work requirements for food stamps to not keep track of whether they're working or in job training or any of those sort of things. Starting on October 1st, people who do have that work requirement are going to have 3 months on food stamps as a limitation unless they are either working or in job training for 20 hours a week.
So this was something that was in place before. It was on hiatus due to the recession, and now it's back.
Exactly.
And this is coupled with what's happening in the federal government. Can you bring us up to speed on that debate?
So just this week, the House of Representatives voted on a very controversial version of the food stamp bill, where they separated it out from the farm bill. And historically, food stamps and farm subsidies have been in the same law. And the House basically passed them separately. The food stamp bill that the House passed includes about $4 billion a year in cuts and ultimately reduces or eliminates food stamps for about 4 million people.
So what's the fate of that bill?
Well, it's very unlikely that that bill will be passed in the Senate, and the president says he will veto it.
Why is this also controversial?
Well, what's happened with the food assistance program, it's actually called SNAP these days, not food stamps. What's happened with that program is that the number of people on it has more than doubled in 10 years, and the cost has also doubled. It's about an $80 billion a year program right now, and there are about 48 million people on it. That's one in seven Americans. So it's the scope of this program has really increased, and in particular, the House Republicans are really calling for some pretty steep cuts, and those cuts on their side are going to have to involve getting people back off of food stamps, reducing eligibility for certain people. Senate Democrats are talking more about cutting loopholes, making the program more efficient, but trying very hard not to push anybody off the rolls.
You spoke to Beth Rubin with the Greene County Job and Family Services, and one of the things that she talked to you about was this idea of the misconceptions about who's actually using these food stamps.
One of the myths that we often hear is that food assistance recipients are not working, don't want to work, are lazy, are simply looking for a handout. And contrary to that fact, most of the people that receive food assistance are either children, elderly folks, or working families. So the perception is incorrect.
So she's talking about around 1.8 million people in Ohio and around 87,000 people in Montgomery County alone who are receiving food stamps. In Ohio, 40% of those people are children.
So we have this deadline of October 1st when these work requirements are going to go into place. What else can we expect to see happen with this food stamp situation?
So one of the things that we haven't heard as much noise about is that the Recovery Act stimulus expanded food stamp benefits for pretty much everybody a few years ago, and that expansion is going away regardless of what happens in Washington. So all food stamp recipients are going to see an average of about $10 a month in cuts per person, $29 a month for a three-person family.
I've been speaking with WYSO's Lewis Wallace. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Springfield residents are allowing one of their own to once again hear the roar of the crowd. WISO's Wayne Baker reports that after years of fundraising, a statue was erected this weekend by the Old South High School to honor boxing legend Davey Moore, which marks the 50th year after his death.
Moore, a native of Springfield, used boxing to climb out of Clark County to eventually compete in the Olympics and later become the featherweight champion of the world. He was internationally known in 1963 when he had a title fight against Cuban defector Sugar Ramos in Los Angeles at Dodger Stadium. The fight was brutal and bloody, and in the 10th round, the 125-pound, 5'2" Moore, known as the Springfield Rifle because his punches made opponents feel like they were being hit by bullets, was knocked out, hitting his head against the bottom rope that was rubber-coated steel. He later gave an interview with reporters in his dressing room, but afterwards he complained of a headache before going into a coma. He never regained consciousness and died a few days later at a Los Angeles hospital. Michael Morris of the Springfield Sculpture Advisory Committee says efforts to raise $90,000 to erect a statue of Moore began nearly 7 years ago. Through public and private donations, the funds were received earlier this year, allowing renowned Urbana-based sculptor Mike Major to complete the 8-foot statue. Moore's statue is the 7th in a series of 10 statues being placed around downtown Springfield to honor its local heroes. Moore is the first African-American to be honored. 77-year-old Geraldine Moore is pleased that her late husband is getting honored. She is also pleased that 71-year-old Sugar Ramos, who now lives in Mexico City, will attend the ceremony. She has not spoken with him since 1963, when he visited the hospital and apologized for landing the blows that put her husband in a coma. She is also anxious to clear up a political falling out that followed the fight. Many, including the Pope, called for an end to boxing because of Davey Moore's death. Singer Bob Dylan even wrote a song in protest of the sport, blaming everybody involved with boxing for causing Moore's death, asking,
"Who killed Davey Moore? Why and what's the reason for? Not me," says the man whose fists laid him low in a cloud of mist, who came here from Cuba's door where boxing ain't allowed no more. I hit him, yes, it's true, but that's what I'm paid to do. Don't say murder, don't say kill, it was destiny, it was God's will.
Geraldine Moore says nobody killed her husband, and she doesn't like the idea of someone believing that.
Sugar Ramos and I, when we saw each other after the fight was over, it was a very sad time for him, and it was a very sad time for me. And we parted as friends, not as enemies. People are asking me about the song that Bob Dylan wrote, Who Killed Davey Moore, and what did I think about it, how did I feel about it. Nobody killed Davey Moore. Davey Moore died. It was a very tragic accident, very tragic. And so you can't blame anyone for that.
Geraldine Moore wants her husband remembered for more than his boxing ability.
He was just a loving person, and that's what I want people to remember him as, a wonderful man that loved his family, and he never met a stranger. And that's what I want people to remember about him, because that is true.
Sugar Ramos, during his visit this weekend, plans to visit Moore's grave in Ferncliff Cemetery and lay a wreath on the former champion's grave. For WYSO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenney. There are more than 2,100 students enrolled this fall in Wright State University's undergrad, engineering, and computer science degree programs, and thanks to a curriculum change the university initiated several years ago, Wright State says students now have a higher chance of completing those programs than ever before. To find out more about all that, I spoke with Professor Nathan Klingbeil, Dean with College of Engineering and Computer Science at Wright State.
We've been looking at a problem that's really a nationwide problem in student success in engineering for a number of years, and we came up with a solution trying to address what we think is the primary bottleneck to student success in our discipline, which is all the required math, specifically the freshman calculus sequence. So we put in a curriculum reform a number of years back now. We've been doing this since 2004 with the support of a number of grants from the National Science Foundation. And essentially, we've introduced an engineering class in the first year where we take all the applications of the way all the math is used in the context of engineering. Why do you need to use calculus in a class on electric circuits, for example? And really trying to connect the dots for the students the minute they walk in the door. So as opposed to a traditional model that identifies most students, even the average incoming student, as underprepared to start the long train of math prerequisites and science prerequisites to pursue engineering. Instead, we've taken the approach of, can we show students the way we're actually going to use these things right when they walk in the door, why it matters for the career field you've chosen. And we've coupled that with really a much more flexible curriculum. Hey, and we've found the approach to have really a dramatic impact, not just on average students or students that maybe even are underprepared, but even our best and brightest students that come in. We find they don't have a good understanding of why all this math that maybe they're already good at, why does this matter for them? And so it's been an enormous success, and we've had very significant impacts on retention of students from first year all the way through graduation. We've now seen multiple classes with significant improvements in six-year graduation performance, students having taken the course.
Serious challenges to changing curriculum like this, or just a lot of research and study?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So, I mean, it's interesting. Here it is 2013, and we're talking about this change that went into effect 2004. To move things in higher education, A, it takes a lot of perseverance to get curriculum approved by faculty and through all the process, but then to actually assess the outcome. When you're trying to address an issue related to student success and graduation rates, one of the reasons it's been so important for us to have sustained National Science Foundation support to develop this and assess the impacts and disseminate the results in a national way is it takes 6 years to get a six-year graduation rate for the very first class, right? And even that, well, that's just the first class. You know, is this sustainable? Does this happen? So for us to really be confident in the long-term impacts of the approach, it's an eight-year kind of proposition. And so, you know, the information we've been disseminating lately is largely based on longitudinal analysis we've done within the last year or so, looking at three incoming classes of students progressing in the new curriculum and 6 years over three classes. It's an eight-year deal to get that done. So that's where we are now.
Okay, so just to clarify, you implemented the changes in 2004, but now you have the data to support the changes and the reasons you made those changes.
Absolutely. And so the key point is, you know, we're always looking for better ways to educate students. And we're convinced the class, you know, it's application-oriented math. It's math in context. It's a lot of team-based interactive learning among the students in the laboratory and the recitation sections that go along. So we know the course is grounded in best practices in education and how people learn. But ultimately, the motivation for the course was trying to uncork traditional bottlenecks to student success in an engineering discipline.
You likened this to a just-in-time system. So can you clarify that?
In education in general, the idea that, you know, that people learn when they can connect new knowledge to their existing context and things that motivate them, right? And so the idea of a traditional model that, say, you know, when you think about traditional state university systems, for example, that developed engineering programs and the way curriculum has evolved over the course of the last century, and where we've established now where we have very common curricula at engineering programs all over the country. Everybody has to take three semesters of calculus, three semesters of physics, and it's all very kind of standardized. But the hierarchical nature of that, which is kind of the opposite of just in time, worked fine back, say, in the 50s and 60s when the entire population of college students was maybe only 10% of the population, right? And so you're only talking about students that if you just tell them, look, trust me, you'll understand why this is important later. They maybe also had the background, the analytical horsepower, or that segment of the population can handle that. You know, and that's the reason why when you look at a lot of R1 institutions that are perfectly happy with high graduation rates, well, when they have entrance requirements that only serve the top 10% of the population, you can stick with traditional curriculum that doesn't connect things in a just-in-time way, and your students can be successful. I would argue that their learning is not as good as it could be if you integrate applications and you connect things more to the rest of the curriculum. So, but when you reach where we are now, where we're worried nationally about graduating enough engineers, computer scientists, right? And regionally in the Dayton region, being able to fill the technology-based economy here, not just for aerospace, but in now advanced manufacturing and those jobs starting to pick up, then, you know, our mission really as a state institution is how do we take a broad section of American high school graduates and have curriculum that is flexible enough, that is adaptable enough, that maintains the rigor of a traditional curriculum, but doesn't keep people out based on virtue of their incoming test scores or what school district they came from. All right, and that's the mission of Wright State University and other mid-sized state universities. You know, our goal is to provide opportunity for higher education, access affordability, but then an opportunity for kids that maybe you wouldn't expect your average American high school graduate to turn into really a superstar and come to our graduate programs for a master's or PhD.
Within the Wright State Engineering program here, are you reaching into the local K-12 education systems?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the class is now EGR 1010 on our semester system, Introductory Math for Engineering Applications. That class has been running successfully in a dual enrollment mode at Bellbrook High School, one of the very, very strong school districts in the area. Very forward-thinking leadership at that institution. They have 4 full years of pre-college engineering opportunities, but they've really realized that what we do with engineering math really tries to connect the things that other K-12 programs like Project Lead the Way, for example, very application-oriented programs, tool-based programs, modern software use, a lot of design content, not a lot of mathematical content, not a lot of kind of connecting. How is this stuff going to happen in your sophomore year classroom? You know, and for us, ultimately, it's extremely important to get kids motivated in doing real-world things. But if you don't also connect to the curriculum and give kids the efficacy that they can handle the rigors of the mathematics. And kids that traditionally think maybe they can't, or you know, that maybe math really isn't my thing, when you set it in the context of the stuff that fires them up, like working on a circuit or things they learned in physics about forces and motion, and you really connect the dots for them, then they get a whole new perspective about their ability to understand math. So for me, the extent to which we can get dual enrollment offerings of this into the programs, we were on the schedule at the Dayton Regional STEM School. Class will run dual enrollment in the spring with the same staff I use that's running the class at Bellbrook right now. So they're just going to go from one school over to the next. And we've had pending proposals at the National Science Foundation. Actually, a thing I'm very interested in pursuing is really trying to roll out engineering math for really advanced preparation of students from areas where they're lower socioeconomic areas. Dayton Public School District, for example, we're thinking about opportunities, collaborations with other programs for underserved populations to get advanced preparation coupled with recruitment. So it's not just, can I have a pathway to let a kid come to college, but can I have them come to college with this extremely improved set of skills that's going to help them be successful when they get there. And so that's another place where we think that engineering math in the high school could have a real impact.
8 years, you finally got results. What are the highlights of some of the results you found?
Yeah, so highlights overall, if we look at traditional population before we ever had the class in place, and now we sort out students across the entire range of ACTs coming in, the one big thing we've seen is that we have completely mitigated the impact of ACT math score on your ability to get a degree. Okay, to the extent that if you were underprepared, you did what you needed to at least get into our EGR 101, now EGR 1010, first year engineering course. Students that take that course with an ACT math of 20 can earn engineering degrees at almost the same rate as kids with an ACT math of 30. Which is an overwhelming result given the predictive capability of ACT. It is a highly well-vetted measure, right? So the fact that we have basically turned what used to be, you know, a kind of a linear predictor or worse of whether or not you can be successful, we've wiped out the effect almost entirely. Okay, and so we've got statistical significance to show that. So that's one huge thing. But what that has done then is the traditional population at Wright State, only about 25%. Of incoming students traditionally ever earned an engineering computer science degree. So, you know, they would self-select out as they go. Students that take EGR 101, our longitudinal data, instead of 25%, we're at 56% earning engineering computer science degrees. And in fact, just graduating from college altogether, the whole efficacy piece that I'm cut out to be a college student, even students that see the applications of the math and say, you know what, I don't like circuits, I don't like forces, I'm not interested in materials, and I'm not that good at programming, or I don't want to do it, maybe they switch to a different major at the university. Students that take our first-year engineering math class earn Wright State degrees at a rate of 70%. University average, typical of state universities, it's somewhere in the mid-40s. And so what we see is a drastic difference on the ability of students to be successful, not just in engineering, but also in college. And when we look at, you know, even traditional groups that have a harder time with success, underrepresented students in engineering, women are extremely underrepresented in engineering. You know, normally talking about 15, 20% of the engineering college might be women. And when we look at the impact on women and then also minority students, for us, minority students, typically black students that came from the region, Dayton City Schools, for example, we look at those groups and groups coming from poor school districts, for example, you know, regardless of race or gender or what district you came from, we see the highest impact on students from underserved backgrounds or students that are otherwise underrepresented. So longitudinally, we've seen graduation rates go from 20% to 60% for students that now take the engineering math course. So we're not talking about a slight improvement. We're talking about doubling kind of numbers. And so even when we first rolled this out, we would put around 100, a little less than 100 kids a year through the class in those first few years. And we look at the impact over 3 years of that. And we have, based on the statistics, in those three classes alone, graduated an additional 78 people with degrees in engineering and computer science. So you think about the impact regionally on the economy. If you can do this at introductory scale, you know, 96 students in the first year. This year at Wright State, 2013, our fall offering can accommodate 308 total students just in the fall. We're almost closed out. Okay? And so if you think about the scale, we graduated an extra 25 kids just from that first year. Just for this year alone, we'll probably graduate 75 to 100 more engineers just because of this change in the curriculum, just for this incoming class, right? So if you think about the impact on the regional economy and the needs that the state has for more people educated and filling the workforce with the growing numbers of jobs in these areas, the changes that are possible by just really thinking about how are we doing things and are we closing out people that could otherwise be successful, not just in engineering but other disciplines, the impact you can make at the higher education level it's significant.
Professor Nathan Klingbeil, Dean with the College of Engineering and Computer Science at Wright State University. Klingbeil says the curriculum model Wright State is now using is one that other colleges and universities across the country are looking at. Cooler temperatures are setting in, and with the change of seasons, we look now to our very own Bill Felker.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of early fall. Many autumns ago, my wife and I camped at the Cumberland Island National Seashore. Accessible only by ferry boat, Cumberland is the southernmost of the Georgia Barrier Islands, a wooded retreat with miles of white and empty beaches, and small herds of wild horses. When we returned home, I started thinking, for some reason, about the wild horses. And I then decided that there should be a herd or two of wild horses in the suburban village where I live. And I came up with a few reasons why this should be so. A herd of wild horses, I concluded, would do more than 100 miles of green space to protect the village from the surrounding society. For a community that allowed free grazing within its borders would set itself well apart from the urban mind. A town full of wild horses would not really be so different because it had wild horses, but because the people in that town wanted them to be there, and because they had different values and priorities. Of course, there would be a few problems with having wild horses, but a place which accepted and solved those problems for the purpose of improving the quality of life for all its residents might be a better place to live than a place which did not. Modern wilderness areas are artificial constructs of civilization, sanctuaries of peace and perspective. Wild horses might remind us that a local habitat, like the fragments of wilderness still alive on Cumberland Island, is also of our own making. That it can be a sanctuary for all of us and for our visitors if we choose to make it so. Impractical and challenging as they might be, wild horses could, like eco-spiritual icons, teach us daily that we are stewards of all creatures and that the wilderness is truly here, not distant and not alien. This is Bill Felker with Burwell's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of early fall. In the meantime, well, of course, think about wild horses in your town.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thanks for listening to WYSO Weekend. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.